This is the I Read Comic Books podcast, and I am your host for this episode, Paul Jaisley. Our intrepid host and international man of mystery, Mike Rappin, is still in Europe on a top secret mission, so we're filling in his absence. But I'm not alone. I'm joined by two wonderful people to talk about comics with, Nick White.
Hey.
And Renee Rodriguez.
What's up?
And of course, I have to ask the question because I'm legally obligated as serving host of the show to ask the question that Mike asks every episode. How are you doing? How have comics been? Let's start with you, Renee.
Well, I'm doing superbly. Comics are always good to me because, you know, they're so warm and fuzzy.
Where are you buying your comics? Yeah,
those are the paper qualities I look for.
I think they're growing mold. Renee, that is not standard storage protocol. We are going to have a talk after this show.
Well, actually, that's very funny because I actually just bagged and boarded like all my comics. And
like all of them?
Yes,
like,
all of literally... them. Oh. I went through all of my collection and I bagged and boarded everything that I own.
Wow. And how many bags and boards did you have to buy?
Like, way too many.
What was your shop's reaction when you're like, okay, I need all of these supplies?
So here's the thing, though, is I've had to like go back like 8 times to do this.
Oh, God.
And it was so bad because I bought like 200 bags and boards the first time, and that wasn't enough. So I had to go back and buy another 100, and it still wasn't enough. So then I asked for my brothers to buy me bags and boards for Christmas, and they did. And then it's just, they'd been sitting there for so long, and I finally was just like, one day I was like, all right, I'm going to do it. I'm going to just finish bagging and boarding everything. And so that was...
So this wasn't like a scenario where you like suddenly found out that like this bagging and boarding thing is something you're like supposed to do. This is something you knew, and then it just spiraled out of control.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, work and life get out of control or whatever, but it was a slow burn. But I had at least like 200 comics not bagged and boarded, and it was terrible. And then I had a free Saturday, and I was like, all right, we're going to do it. And it took forever. And I was getting pestered by like 8 other people. They were like, what are you doing? Don't waste your Saturday. And I was like, get
I'm
off
doing
my
back. Job.
Yeah.
I'm doing my duties. So long boxes or short boxes, Renee? I have to ask. It's the proverbial boxers or briefs on this show.
It's actually both.
Okay.
I filled 2 long boxes, and I have half of a short box, and then all of my trades on my bookshelf. So
okay.
So and I actually this is actually after giving away like half of my collection like a year or two ago. I had to get rid of some stuff.
Sure.
Why? No.
Well, I needed to fit. I needed to just cut some of the fat, and there were some series that weren't that great. But yeah. Other than that, comics have been good to me. Mostly reading manga right now because I'm waiting on the paycheck. But other than that, comics have been good. You know, just reading.
Manga's pretty economical. I know very little, but from like our discussions and from sort of, I think a lot of the manga fire that you ignited under Mike Rappin again. Thank you very much for that.
You're welcome.
you know, it's been weird to hear you guys talk about like pricing and everything for all of this, and I'm like, what the hell? Like, manga is cheap. I mean, mm-hmm. I see the books, I see the paper quality, and I'm like, what's that about?
Oh, it's wonderful.
But, yeah.
I love it. I have this one manga that's almost it's almost like 15 years old, and it's still fantastic. Sometimes the binding gets a little worn, but the paper is still like awesome. And there's also digital comics now, and there's sales all over. Like, you can still get Weekly Shonen Jump on Comixology, but also like Comixology has sales. Viz and Funimation have sales for stuff like all the time. And you can also, if you have Crunchyroll, you can read weekly chapters.
Yeah, I remember when you were saying that, like, the weekly collection of...
Yeah, whatever Weekly Shonen Jump.
...group of manga that is like $2 for however many pages, and I was... Yeah. That was shocking.
Yeah, it's like it's like $2 or $3 for about 20 chapters of different stories, and each chapter is about 20 pages. So
that's just crazy.
Bonkers. So, well, is there anything you've read recently that you want to talk about, Renee?
Yes. Sorry about that. We kind of went off on a tangent.
On this show, that never happens.
Yeah, those aren't... We don't have tangents. We just have mistakes that get cut out later. Cut that one, Xander. I dare you.
Anywho, yes. One of the series that is really great in Shonen Jump right now, which is sort of becoming one of the new flagship series, is Dr. Stone. And it's about the world has entered a new Stone Age, and a couple of people from... You know, modern times have been trapped in stone for like 3,000 years, and they've just broken out to this Stone Age. And one of them is a scientist, and he's trying to recreate the civilization of science. And it's really funny, and it's really cool. It's very interesting. And they just made ramen, and they just made a light bulb to prove that they could. And it's so incredibly silly, and it's awesome. And apparently now they're going to make cola, and...
All the important stuff. Ramen, well, light bulbs, cola.
Well, it's because...
I just want to make certain I understand this right. So this isn't like a modern-day Encino Man sort of scenario where someone's been trapped and it's like, welcome to the future. It's not like that. This is... You've been trapped and now we're maybe even further back in time than whenever you were trapped.
No. It's they've gone further in time. So it's more like the time machine. That the future has progressed so much that something happened to the world, and now everything is back to like a Stone Age type thing. But
right. So that's what I'm saying. Yeah. It's sort of like the little homage at the beginning of Futurama, where you see everything speed up and the aliens keep coming back and destroying Earth over and over and over again. So this person like wakes up and it's like, welcome to the future. It's just as bad as it's actually way worse than what you remember.
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh, I like that. That's very dark.
Yeah,
that's,
but there's also like somehow there's humans that have survived or whatever. So he's trying to recruit them to his he calls it his civilization of science. So he's trying to recruit them. So that's why he made ramen. Was he made them because basically all they eat is like legumes and grilled fish. So he's like, I'm gonna make ramen, something you've never had before, and then you're gonna become my
slaves.
Here's some
cola for your teeth, and I'll work on toothpaste in a couple years.
Well, the cola thing was because like it's called Dr. Stone because like all the humans at one point in the world were turned to stone, and so they found a way to sort of unpetrify them. And so this guy gets unpetrified, and he's from our time, and so he eats the bowl of ramen. He goes, oh, man, this would be really good if I had cola with it. So he asks the scientist, he's like, do you think you could make cola? And it's... It sounds outrageous without being able to explain everything that happens in the story, because there's so much, and we're like 26 chapters in, which doesn't seem like that long, but so much has already happened. And it's a really good series, and I would say, like, if there's... Actually, I can't even say that because I can't say like, oh, if there's one series, you absolutely need to read this because there's so many. But like, it's not that far along.
As long as that book begins with just the narration and it starts with, at first I was afraid, I was petrified.
No. boo. Like, no. No thanks, Nick.
I think I'm laughing more at Paul's, just the disappointment in his voice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's very used to it by now.
Yeah, I know. I should have seen that coming. Yeah.
I would just say because Dr. Stone doesn't have that many chapters out, so a lot of people are worried about like picking up a series and having so much to read it. But this series is still really new, so I would say read it. It's a fun read. That's it. I've taken up too much time, so I'm going to end it there for my part.
Okay. Well, that does sound interesting. I'll have to check that stuff out. So what about you, Nick? What have you been reading?
I've been reading a good amount. Things have been pretty busy. This whole weekend has sort of just been a nonstop blur of work and then more work and then coming into work and then caught a little bit of the football games yesterday that I know that so much of our listening base loves so very much.
Yeah, sports.
So I, rather than talk about that stuff, which I know all of you, relate to on a very intimate and heartfelt level, I'll talk about a few of the books that I've been reading. I read Skin and Earth number 2. This is the second installment in the miniseries done by Dynamite. It seems like a very weird fit for Dynamite, but I guess it had to happen somewhere. And this is the book that's being written, drawn, colored, lettered, everything by the synth pop star Lights, who's a Canadian musician. And I'm a huge, huge fan of her music, have been for probably nearly 10 years. And she's always done a lot of her promotional art for albums and a lot of her album covers, although I think that was largely true of some of her older stuff. But this comic is actually meant to be a tie-in to her upcoming album that's coming out, I think, in maybe a week or two. And so certain songs are linked to certain parts of the comic, and certain parts of the comic actually use lyrics that are in the songs, or is it vice versa? Who knows? But it's kind of a post-apocalyptic narrative where the world's population is sort of divided into the people who end up living near the really, you know, dangerous, gunky chemical, like, you know, you're probably going to breathe this for 20 years and then die, you know, areas, and then sort of the cleaner areas. And it focuses on a character who has a special past that allows her to move between the zones, even though she lives in sort of the very chemically, like, ooh, don't want to be here, probably need a hazmat suit and, you know, a full, you know, 500 gallon tub of Purell in my house. But it's very interesting. It's even more interesting when we don't really have the album yet. So it's kind of, I mean, we have a couple of the songs, but you know, I haven't really engaged with that many projects that have this sort of full multimedia experience bouncing back and forth between mediums. So it's an interesting sort of experience to have. Yeah. So I've enjoyed that. And it's very odd because she's very clearly like a self-trained artist, and so there are certain things you see in her art that you're like, you know, I don't really know if this is something I would see from a different artist, but her behind the scenes parts in the back, which talk about how she sort of is kind of learning as she goes, that's mm-hmm. very entertaining and very interesting, because with a lot of other artists it's like, you know, obviously I did this and obviously I did that, and, you know, well, no duh, I used this color palette. And with her it's kind of like, well, I learned how this works, and then I kind of, it's a very behind the scenes that I find super enlightening, and for someone who, you know, doesn't know that much about the full process, I thought that was pretty engaging.
Interesting.
What else? I read Mr. Miracle number 1. That's the new one. That's right. Contrarian Nick finally got around to it. I'll quickly say a few things about that. And look, I'm not trying to stir shit up here, but I guess that's what's going to happen. Was it good? Yeah, it was good. Was it probably a little bit overhyped? Of course. Welcome to 2017. Nothing doesn't get overhyped these days. I think what was interesting is that for me, what worked so well about this book was how little it did reveal about things. Like, you learn, at least for me, I don't know what it was like for you, Paul, that like you learn not really to trust Scott as a character.
Right.
He doesn't seem to know where he is. He doesn't seem to know who he is. His memories don't seem very reliable. Is he grounded in our world, like a very realistic world, or is he grounded in sort of that Kirby world of the older comics? I think as a setup issue and as a mystery, I found it very good. And I thought Mitch Garrett's art was fantastic, especially a lot of the stuff that looked like a 1950s distorted TV or like a bad VHS tape, where, you know, the colors and the tracking are all off. I thought as a setup issue and as sort of a really muddying the water issue, I thought it was good, but I don't know. I didn't think it was quite what everyone else thought it was, but maybe it's just because I've been spoiled and have thought comics have been so good for a while now that I didn't think they needed rescuing. Like, apparently a bunch of these critics, oh, comics have just, you know, they've been, you know, it's been a death knell for years, and Mr. Miracle shows up, and it's like, Mr. Miracle is a good book. Comics have been good recently.
I do think it is a little disingenuous in that regard, because it, for a book from DC or Marvel, it is very, very good. But the thing is, there's other publishers doing just as interesting stuff that doesn't get as much
coverage. And I think the real tragedy is, even with Marvel and DC, they've been doing interesting and weird things here and there too, exactly. But apparently that stuff went by the wayside of a lot of these people, like, you know, Omega Man or Vision, you know, as we've talked about, and even some of the more popular books have actually gotten critical acclaim. So that's, you know, I guess everyone just needs to read Animal Man and then I will stop complaining.
Okay, there you go. You fixed comics yet again.
I was actually thinking about reading Animal Man recently. I don't remember why. I just remember thinking like...
Which one, Renee? The Lemire run or the Morrison run? Or I guess if you're really weird, one of the ones in between the two. Yeah.
No, I wanted to start from the New 52 and then just like get to current.
Sure.
Okay.
So you know what it was? Is I was watching that Teen Titans movie, and I remember Mike Rappin telling me back in the day that they were going to have Beast Boy in the New 52 somehow be related to the Red, which was Animal Man's thing or something. And so I was like, oh, you know what? Oh. I should read Animal Man, because I wonder if they actually did that with Beast Boy. But I don't remember, because I think that got retconned after DC Rebirth. So I guess it doesn't matter, but at the same time, I still like feel like I should read Animal Man.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. The art style isn't for everyone, but Travel Foreman's art is definitely an acquired taste. But for horror, I think you really can't do much better than that. Let's see, a few other brief things. Secret Weapons 3 oddly got sort of political and wanted to discuss the issues of discrimination and police brutality and whatnot, and it was very interesting to have that in this book. But then again, with Secret Weapons in a lot of ways being sort of a contemporary allegory to X-Men, I guess we shouldn't be really shocked that it's addressing things like that. Cave Carson has a cybernetic eye, number 8. Probably should have been called Cave Carson had a cybernetic eye, number 8. Cue the air horn noises right here, and here, and there. And it's a weird issue. I don't really understand why his brain still seems to be acting and working as if... It's like he has like a phantom eye. It's like the equivalent of a phantom limb. It's no longer there, but for some weird reason, it seems to be functioning in weird ways. I'm sure Paul can obviously touch on this way more than I ever could in terms of where that is, because he's not behind. Lastly, I want to just briefly say Dark Knight's Metal number 1 for me is really my big focus for this week. I was actually very pleasantly surprised for all of the overhyping that Mr. Miracle got. I think DC Metal probably was for most people coming in with lower expectations. Snyder recently hasn't been totally hitting it out of the park for me with All-Star Batman, and of course this is in some ways, for better or for worse, still a summer event, so expectations were I think a little bit diminished for a lot of people. And of course, adding to the fact that we've been hearing about this book for what, Paul, like a year and a half at this point?
Yeah,
it's been a while.
And so it's been a while, as you know, Nickelback put it. Oh, sorry, that was Stained. What am I thinking?
How dare you?
2002 music, get out. But I really enjoyed it. It was so much fun. You've got like Red Tornado. You've got Batman riding dinosaurs. You've got Hawkman and Hawk Girl and this big sort of mystery going on. And you've got a Mongol and like a weird fun gladiator scene opening. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
There's a Power Rangers homage that I don't want to spoil that made me laugh out loud. I really enjoyed it. Really, really enjoyed it. Tonally, it was very different than the casting and the Forge for me, and I think that's what really threw me off. It was actually a lot more fun than those two books
definitely
seemed to make me think it was going to be.
So that, I mean, that speaks to a generational difference, because where you saw a Power Rangers reference, I saw a Voltron reference.
Voltron?
So, I mean, that speaks to the difference here in age. But no, that was a very good issue. So, for my case, I'll be brief because I haven't honestly read a ton of comics, but a few of the highlights that I read, I'm woefully behind, so I'm catching up on a lot of stuff. Just read Killer Be Killed number 11. Issue 12, of course, comes out this week, so I, you know, got in just under the wire, I guess. What can you say about this book? It's perfect. Brubaker and Phillips are two of the best doing it right now, and they're always surprising me with the tricks they have up their sleeve, and this book is a testament to that.
Yes,
very
absolutely.
Good, very, very good book. Future Quest Presents Space Ghost number 1. I had no idea this book even existed until it showed up in my pull box a couple weeks ago.
No.
It is a Space Ghost themed Future Quest book written by Jeff Parker with art by Ariel Olivetti, who, of course, his art style is about as different from Doc Shaner's as you can get. But yeah. Ariel Olivetti is great at drawing aliens in spaceships, so a Space Ghost book makes perfect sense. This was a lot of fun, and if you didn't read the Future Quest series, you can jump right now with this book because it recaps that series and gives you an origin story for Space Ghost. It's actually kind of a sad issue because it kind of talks about how Space Ghost became to be and how he lost everything, and that's why he's an avenging spirit type figure. It's a really good book, and I'm just glad to see Jeff Parker doing the stuff more. Cave Carson Has a Cybernetic Eye, number 11. That was the most recent issue, I think. Again, I'm a little behind, but Nick...
I think that's right.
Nick, yeah. This book gets even weirder than issue 8, so strap in. This book is absolutely bonkers. And this issue, we actually find out where the cybernetic eye came from and how it got into Cave's head. Won't spoil it, but I absolutely love this book. It's such a weird trip and feels so different from any other book being published right now. DC or anybody else. It's such a unique book. I love it.
And of course, Wild Dog.
Of course. I love Wild Dog.
Wild Dog.
But the biggest thing I got this week that I've been really enjoying, I'm working my way through and really savoring, is Kirby 100, which is a big softcover book published by Tomorrow's Publishing. That's the company that publishes the Jack Kirby Collector, the annual magazine that's sort of chronicling Jack Kirby's work, because there's so much of it, they're always discovering new pages. Someone has to keep track of all of it. And for the Kirby's 100th anniversary, they published this big book called Kirby 100, and it is just that. 100 different comic creators sharing their thoughts on their favorite Jack Kirby stories. It's a really fun book. It's organized chronologically, so you get a sense of Jack's career from the 40s up until the 80s. It's a who's who of contributors to this, people that worked with him, like Mike Royer and Joe Sinnott. You have people that were influenced by Kirby, like Bruce Timm, Brendan McCarthy, Alan Davis. I mean, just everybody. Mike Allred, Tom Scioli. Just, it's a who's who of comic creators nerding out about Kirby and all their favorite stuff. It's a really fun book and definitely recommended for somebody that maybe knows of Jack Kirby's importance but doesn't quite understand what the big deal is. I think this is a really nice look at just the breadth of his output and his influence. So, really enjoying that.
Is that a manageable book of a manageable size and a manageable price, or is it as insane as it sounds?
No, it's a little oversized. It's about a magazine-sized book. It's a soft cover. I think you can find it. I think I ordered it on Amazon, and it was like $25, so it's not outrageous.
Okay.
I highly recommend it. It's got a nice chronology of Kirby's career. Yeah, great stuff. And I like that when they get to the New Gods stuff, like 8 different creators pick issue number 7 of New Gods as their favorite Jack Kirby story. Because it's mine. The Pact. It's one of the best. Okay. Enough about Kirby for now.
Awesome.
More importantly, let's just talk about the week that's coming in comics and what we're excited for this week. Of course, comics will be arriving in your local comic shop on Wednesday, September 13th. So let's start with you, Nick. What are you excited for this week?
I haven't broken the rules in a while, so I figure it's about time. For me, it would be one of two things. You're already going to be discussing what I was otherwise going to discuss, but okay. That book needs no help or introduction. So for me, it's Grass Kings number 7, which of course is the introductory issue of the second arc. I'm really, really excited for this. The first arc ended on a note that managed to neatly wrap up a lot of the main conflict in the town, which was, I guess it's not really a town, it's a, you know, utopia of sorts, a utopian society. And that was mainly dealing with the conflict of the neighboring town. This arc has transitioned so very well into a problem that was very carefully seeded during the first arc. And it's a potentially much more sinister problem. And this one might have to do with the utopian society's past. So it's always interesting for me to watch comics transition from one arc to the second arc, and sort of how do we set up the second problem, and is it very Deus Ex Machina and clunky, or here's the next villain, let's roll out the next one, you know, somebody, you know, turn the lever and, you know, get the next Rogues Gallery member, or if it's just very organic and carefully set up and sort of makes you go, oh my goodness, how could I forget about that? And that's sort of how I feel about this second arc of Grass Kings. Otherwise, it would be Ninjak number zero. This will be the last issue of Matt Kint's run on Ninjak, which I believe has lasted probably 2.5 years, give or take. So it's his last issue. He's handing over the reins to Christos Gage, who has kind of had a bit of a, I would say, a bit of a journeyman career. He's done DC work. He's done Marvel work. He's worked on Daredevil, the show, for Netflix. I feel it's in pretty capable hands. He's done some valiant work before with Hardcore. So I'm optimistic. It's going to have Thomas Giorello on art. I feel pretty good about that. And it's kind of a nice way to see Kint off and kind of have Gage come in, both on the same issue. They're both writing different stories within the same oversized book. So kind of a nice little passing of the torch within the same issue. So those are the two things I'm looking forward to. What about you, Renee?
Well, since I broke the rules last time, I made sure to only do one pick this time because Mike got really mad at me. So
well, Mike's not here this week, so anything goes.
Well, I only came prepared for one, so.
Okay.
But my pick is Haikyuu Volume 15 by Haruichi Furudate. It's a manga. Who could have seen this coming? It's a volleyball manga, and it's really interesting. As lame as that sounds, it's super, super interesting, and the art is fantastic. I would say literally pick up this manga just for the incredible angles and just the art of just the sport. It's so thrilling, and it gets you pumped, especially if you've ever been in sports. You get that same sort of feeling. And Volume 15 is there right in the middle of a really big qualifier tournament to see who's going to go to nationals, which if you've read any sports manga, it's a really big thing. But you're not even following the main team in this volume. It's two of their biggest enemies seeing who they're going to face in the semifinal, either this school called Date Tech or this one called Aoba Josai or Blue Castle, which really threw me. Because I watched the anime first and then started reading it. And so I was used to them saying Aoba Josai. And then suddenly in the book, they're like, oh, yeah, Blue Castle. And I'm like, who is Blue Castle? I don't remember this person at all. But that match is really, really good. And it's a really, again, the art is absolutely insane. And I know it's like 15 volumes in, but even just pick up the first volume, it's really good. But if you've heard of this series, and if you're reading it, this volume is absolutely it's got one of the best matches in the series, just in it. And it came out
honestly,
last
these
week.
Manga things, like my favorite thing, hearing you and Mike talk about this, Renee, are these manga series where it's like they're redefining what it means to be like a niche series. It's like, what's this one about? This one's volleyball. What's this one about? This one is about using a power sander with 100 grit sandpaper. Is that what this is about? Yeah, that's what this one's about. Next week, it's going to be about cuisine dishes that only use celery. It's like these things are all so like hyper. Like I feel like the niche of these books is like, what things do people not give a shit about, and we are going to like do a deep dive, like a major deep dive, until you care. And it's weird because for me, that's massively interesting when you're dealing with, it's like, this is something you don't give a shit about on a day-to-day process, you know, like this what's this book about? Competitive shoe tying, really? Yeah, it's a thing. And we're gonna do 7 arcs. And no, I mean, it's I find that massively interesting, all things aside.
It's fascinating
that they're so hyper focused.
It's actually really funny that you mention that, because there is a series called Behind the Scenes.
Oh no, Renee. That's
it's literally about like people that do set design in college and they're learning how to do it. You reminded me of this because of the sandpaper thing. Because it's all about these people that are good at crafting.
God,
that's great. That's so great.
Yeah, and there is...
When Mike told me about the manga that's about making manga, I was like, all right, we're there.
Oh, good, though. That's one of my favorites. That's so good. And actually, one of the first manga I ever read is called Hikaru no Go, and it's about this kid that ends up becoming a professional Go player, which is this really old Japanese
Go
game.
Go is like the board game, right?
Yeah,
like the chess variation.
Looks kind of like Chinese checkers, maybe.
Yeah, it's like,
this is one with the blue, black, and white. Well, I guess that's chess too, Nick.
They're black and white stones. It's a capturing stones game. It's one of the oldest strategy games, and it was invented in China, but it's popular in Japan and Korea as well. And
I just realized I've been playing the Tomb Raider Go. Basically, they did Tomb Raider Go for the phone or whatever, and I'm just only very stupidly recognizing now that it's clearly based on what you are. Jesus. Okay. Huh. Moment of truth on the air. Anyway, that embarrassing reveal aside, Paul, let's talk about the other book that I'm actually super psyched for.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those weeks where there's a ton of awesome books coming out, so it's hard to pick just one, but I'm going to go against my gut of picking Mr. Miracle number 2 and pick Dark Knight's Metal number 2 by Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo, just because it's a bonkers, over-the-top superhero comic, and that's totally my jam, which we'll talk about more about later this episode, why that's my jam. But I love that this book, this big DC event, it feels like an event, and I never really thought I'd be nostalgic for 90s-style comic book events, but that's totally what this book is doing for me. That's the itch it's scratching. You have the Justice League tracking down a sort of ancient mystery that's haunted the DC universe. As we mentioned in issue 1, there is a Voltron-esque assemblage of the Justice League that has to fight Mongol, basically. You have all sorts of deep, divey, nerdy references to DC continuity. Again, that's totally my jam. And it's Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo. I mean, that is... In terms of creative teams, that's one of the best and biggest names going right now. So it has that special feel to it, and I'm really, really enjoying that. And I have no idea.
Go ahead,
Paul. I have no idea what's in store for this book, and I think that's what's making it exciting as well.
The weirdest thing for me about it that I forgot to mention earlier is that it actually ties in All-Star Batman. I didn't think it was going to. I thought that book was so totally isolated all by itself. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, see second arc of All-Star Batman issues 6 through 12 or whatever. And I was like, wow.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting just how much Scott Snyder is reaching back to his Batman run, you know, from the New 52 and pulling stuff out and tying up those loose ends, of which there were more than I remembered, and incorporating into this book. It sounds like a backhanded compliment, but this is my favorite Scott Snyder because it's kind of Grant Morrison light. And I don't mean that as a put down. Sure. I think Scott Snyder has his own style that I totally like. He's not aping or trying to mimic Grant Morrison, but when he took over Batman, he was using a lot of the same concepts and ideas that Grant Morrison did, but just doing his take on it. And I really feel that this book is the same thing, where I never really liked American Vampire. I didn't like witches as much as everyone else did. But this is Scott Snyder is my jam, and it's just, I love the over-the-top geekiness of it and the willingness to just go anywhere the story demands and just explore these corners of the DC universe that I haven't seen in a while. So I'm really, really enjoying this series. I think it's going to be really special by the time it's all wrapped up.
So this week on the show, we're going to be talking about the topic of sort of what your childhood interests were in terms of literary interests, media interests, the sort of things that you were really, you know, paying attention to or found engaging as a kid, and more specifically, and to bring things back to comics and to bring things back to modern day, how you think that affects the sort of books you read, or more specifically, obviously, the comics that you find interesting? Is there sort of a direct link to reading works about the same franchises or people as a kid? Or perhaps is there like more of a kind of interesting disconnect? Or is it, you know, were you reading comics as a kid? Were you not? Was that something you were allowed to do? Was that something you wanted to but you couldn't? And just sort of looking at how that shaped you down the way, down the road. So now that I've turned this into a real blanket statement of a blanket statement, let's just let the anecdotes fly here.
Yeah.
Paul Jaisley, rescue me from the clutches of whatever this is.
What I think is interesting is being on the show and listening to the show and talking to the people that are into comics, how many comics readers nowadays discover comics or get into comics when they're in their late teens or in college. And for someone like me, I've always read comics, and they've just always been something that I was interested in since I was a kid. And I think that's, again, a sort of a generational divide where it's previous generations, comics were always seen as more of like a childhood or childish thing, not to be negative or, you know, a pejorative sense, but they're always something that you read as a kid and then you either grow out of or you don't. Whereas nowadays,
it's like a stepping stone.
Yeah. Whereas like nowadays, yeah. I think more and more people are discovering comics later in life, and therefore the comics that they enjoy tend to be different. A lot of people and people on this show don't read a ton of superhero comics because that's not what they started with. And for me personally, I liked superheroes before I even read a comic book. The very earliest memories I have are of, you know, the action figures I had, the Kenner Superpowers action figures and the mini comics that came with those, watching the Superpowers cartoon, seeing Darkseid on the cartoon, and then later, when I was a little bit older, discovering all those characters had their own comic series. So my introduction was superheroes first into comics, where I feel that's less common with a lot of newer readers.
Yeah, I think you're completely right. I mean, I know that they still talk regularly about how the average age of a comic book reader is what? It's probably like 36 at this point. It's something like that.
Yeah.
And I think that is changing. I think, you know, time will tell. But I do believe you're completely right. Comic book readers, by and large, you know, newer comic book readers are... sorry, let me rephrase that. I think there are a lot of people that are coming to comics now, regardless of their age, you know, whether it's something, you know, a kid that's sort of being brought up in it, or someone like myself who, in the grand scheme of things, you know, comics is still sort of a more recent 7-8 years thing for me. And of course, I think a lot of that has to do with just accessibility, right? I mean,
yeah,
when I was growing up, most of my exposure to comics was that the local supermarket store had the, you know, revolving, rotating rack, you know, and that was pretty much it. If you lived in a smaller town, you probably didn't have a store that was dedicated to comics. And if we're talking about going far enough back in time, as ancient as I am, before the heyday of the internet, you know, you weren't going to get a digital copy. You weren't going to get a PDF. Comixology was not a thing. So you pretty much had this grocery store option. And even then, you couldn't probably get that involved because it was always a huge, you know, risk. If you really got involved in comics, you know, next month, are they going to order, you know, continue to order this book or not?
Yeah, so there was always the risk of missing the next chapter, missing the next issue because... there was no pull lists. I mean, my very earliest comic book memories were buying issues off the stand at the supermarket. And it's like, I didn't even think of them as being continuing stories. I just would buy a comic and read it over and over again for a couple months and then buy another one. You know what I mean? It wasn't until later that you figure all that stuff out. And I think, again, nowadays it's so different for a lot of people. And I think that's what makes this kind of interesting topic is what books do you read now? And was that influenced by something other than early exposure to comics?
Right. Exactly. What about you, Renee? Were you reading at a young age, or I guess were you reading comics at a young age, or what were you reading?
Well, I mean, I guess it's kind of like what you guys said. Like, it was really hard to find continuous comics. Instead, you're sort of doing like the Flash Gordon episode guide of comic book reading, where you're just picking up random episodes of different series. But I started reading comics because I'm the youngest of five. So my brothers, all got toys and comic books and, you know, VHS tapes of old comic book shows from, like, other family members years before I was even born. And then I also grew up in California, so we would go to swap meets all the time, and we'd find, you know, different comics, and we'd pick them up and buy them for, like, you know, a cent, and they're, like, falling apart and stuff like that. So,
sure.
And my oldest brother, Eric, who is 8 years older than me, when I was, like, six, he was in middle school or something like that, he actually had a Wizard Comics subscription. So you could find out what was going on currently in the comics from Wizard. In the back, they would tell you what was happening, and they also had, like, previews and stuff like that. So I did read comics, but it was just, like, the precious few that we had, and I would read the Wizard magazines that we would get over and over again. And the thing was, apparently, this is something I only found out recently, is I was the only one that read them, because a lot of my other brothers don't like to read. They just like to look at their pictures and never actually read what was going on in the story.
Sure.
So eventually
that's still true of a lot of people reading comics these days.
Eventually all these comics would become mine, because I would read them over and over again. I'd keep asking them for like, hey, can I borrow your comic book? I want to read it again. And they would be like, you know what, dude, it's fine, it's yours. And then I think there was, like, one Christmas my brother bought me my own comic book. It was, like, the first one that was mine. It was Spider-Man 2099, issue 18 or 19, and I still remember it. I found it in a comic book shop not that long ago, and I freaked out because I remembered the cover, and I was like, I know exactly what's going on here.
He's like, sir, if you want to buy the comic, you're just going to need to buy the comic. Quit standing around. Childhood nostalgia be damned if you're not going to buy something.
It's in the library. Buy it or get out.
I didn't even know that comics were in libraries until I was in college, and, like, someone in the comic book club told me, they're like, oh, yeah, I read comics at my library all the time. And I was like, you what?
Yeah, you lying sack of shit.
I was like, that's a thing? Like, I was like, I used to hang out at the library. I never saw that.
And, yeah. Back in the day, libraries used to be an institution of learning. Now it's comic books and computers. It's like, we got to be relevant. No, you don't. Just old leather-bound books, and that's what people want, okay? No, that's interesting, because I think you're completely right. When I was growing up, and I went to the library a lot and participated in my fair share of those summer library reading contests, like, comic books at the library was basically, do you want a collected book of Dilbert comic book strips, or do you want a collected book of Garfield?
Or Calvin and Hobbes, Heathcliff.
Calvin and Hobbes, My mainstay, Family Circus, keeping it real.
No, I mean, so, yeah, speaking of Calvin Hobbes, it's actually kind of interesting, because I remember being a kid and really liking Calvin Hobbes. You know, every Sunday they'd have the big oversized edition of it, where Bill Watterson could just go nuts and do whatever he wanted. And then I had the well-worn, dog-eared copies of the collections. And that was the first time I remember really thinking about how cartooning works, the panel to panel transition, noticing different art styles. And that was, like, the first time I really thought about comics as an art form, which I think, you know, related back to this topic, influences the way I think about comics now, where I really try to notice that stuff and see what's going on. It all traces back to just spending Sunday afternoons poring over at Calvin Hobbes and seeing all that stuff played out that way. I noticed that more in that than I did comic books at the time, because I was reading comics in the 80s and 90s, and they weren't great, you know, especially the stuff I was reading. But so I'm definitely, Calvin Hobbes, oddly enough, is a big influence on not just the kind of comics I read, but what I look for when I'm reading comics these days.
Yeah, no, I think Calvin and Hobbes is a great example, and I think it's something that a lot of us were reading at a younger age. And yeah, there's something about it, and it's kind of ineffable. I don't know. I guess if you got around to it, you could probably get at it. There's something about it that kind of transcends your usual day-to-day strip. You know what I mean? Yeah. There was something that removed it from a lot of that other stuff, largely in terms of style, in terms of, you know, the risks it was willing to take and the whole spaceman spiff thing. And like you said, I mean, there was just a whole spectrum of different styles. So I started with a lot of those trades, a lot of those collections. And then in terms of like getting like singles when I was a kid, that was pretty much just restricted to like Star Wars comics. Usually what would happen is whenever I was sick and my dad would go to get the, you know, to get the medicine and to get the ginger ale or whatever, and he had a flu or a cold or whatnot, usually he'd be like, "And I need to make a connection with my son on a capitalist friendly level. Let's buy him a comic." I'm kidding. My dad and I have a great relationship. And so now it sounds like I don't. No. So Shadows of the Empire number 5. Sorry, Dad. Just kidding. You don't listen. You're unsupportive. No, I'm just kidding.
I mean, I didn't think we'd get this deep.
Nick White's
into
family
this
drama unfolds.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I didn't think we'd get that, this deep on this episode. So
yeah,
that's what happens. You bring up childhood. Secrets going
exactly
skeletons rolling out the closet.
Yeah, at least all the other people that want to talk about my childhood, I'm paying them, okay?
Right.
So but so yeah, I read Shadows of the Empire and it was number 5, and for those who don't know or aren't in the know on sort of where Star Wars was in the early 90s, you know, following Return of the Jedi, there really wasn't that much. Like, there was nothing in the Star Wars universe going on, really, until Timothy Zahn wrote his, I think it was called Heir to the Force trilogy in the early 90s.
Heir to the Empire.
And slowly, Heir to the Empire, right. And people were like, holy cow, you know, these books, they weren't the best thing ever, but, you know, there was like, holy shit, you know, there is an audience for Star Wars 7-8 years after Return of the Jedi. And eventually they did this thing called Shadows of the Empire, which was this kind of multimedia thing. It had a video game, it had a comic book series, it had a novelization. And so, you know, I have really fond memories of that comic, which basically tried to fill the gap between Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. Mm-hmm. And it kind of got my mind thinking about basically about how canon works. And, you know, okay, so I've seen Empire Strikes Back and I've seen Return of the Jedi. And so this happens in between. So like Han Solo's in Carbonite, and that's why I'm not seeing him in the story. And sort of looking at how all of the pieces fall into place, which is sort of like such a subconscious thing when you're dealing with like modern comics and whatnot about, you know, canon, you know, canon must work and it has to, everything has to fit together. And obviously canon was such a huge part of, and is still to this day a huge part of Star Wars. And they are like, they have like two dedicated people whose only jobs are to look at all of the Star Wars product going out and make sure everything lines up.
Right.
And so, you know, it really got me thinking about canon in a way that, you know, as I read comics now, even though I wasn't reading comics that much as a kid, it's so second nature now, you know, because that's how you analyze things and piece together all these different narratives that are coming from all these different multimedia approaches.
Yeah.
But they're still telling this one grand story, you know?
Yeah, that's really interesting because, you know, for me, again, I knew about superheroes and I always had superhero stuff around, so that's kind of why I got into comics. But my experience of reading a lot of early books, I still have the very first picture books I ever had as a kid, and they're about Superman. And there's 4 of them. There's How Superman Came to Earth, The Adventures of Super Baby, when Superman was Superboy, Superman and Metropolis. There's these little tiny books. They're illustrated by Ramona Fraiden, so I've always had a soft spot for her artwork. And there's images in these books that are just burned into my brain, and they always will be because I spent hours poring over them. But reading those books, playing with the superpowers action figures, so the Kenner superpowers, which are based on the Jack Kirby Fourth World stuff, I always had that stuff around, and I was mesmerized by the details of the characters. Like figuring out whose alter ego was who, how they're related to each other, what their weaknesses were, what their powers were. I was just fascinated by all that. And by the time I was old enough, because this is like 84, 83, 84, 85. By the time I was old enough to read comics, Crisis on Infinite Earths had happened and all that had changed. you know? So I'm trying to read comics. I'm like, wait, these characters aren't what I remember at all. So it's kind of this weird learning curve to try to like keep up with all that. So that's why still one of my favorite Batman stories is Untold Legend of the Dark Knight or Untold Legend of the Batman, because I read that book over and over and over again, and I memorized all of the pre-crisis details of Batman. And then when I was old enough to read comics and to see the Batman movie in 1989, it was all different than what I remembered. And I was kind of fascinated by that, that comics changed, the characters changed over time.
That's really interesting to me, because I can see someone as a kid, like, that moment happens, and you're like, well, what the fuck? All of this was for nothing? Well, like, what the hell? No, like, who's this guy? What's going on? But, you know, you dug into it, which, you know.
And that's why, you know, I hinted at it earlier in this episode, that's why a big DC event like Metal really scratches an itch for me, because it is a deep dive in continuity, and that's kind of what I fell in love with first, was DC Comics and the characters, before I even read a single issue of their comics.
Definitely, definitely. Were you guys reading other things as kids that you think sort of shaped or influenced the sort of comic books you read now, or... Or is there anything?
Yeah. So, like I said, I came from a family of five, and we actually became known at my school as the comic book family because we knew everything. But it wasn't because we had all the comics, but we did this grocery store thing where we'd go and we'd read the comics and we would actually buy the collectible cards, the Marvel Metal cards from back. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys remember those. But they had all those different collectible cards that would tell you the whole storylines and all the different things on the back of the card. And we bought like every single one of those. And we've definitely got them around somewhere. So we knew everything, like from the original Clone Saga to the Infinity Stones and Crisis on Infinite Earths, so all that. And so we knew everything because of these Marvel Metal cards. And so I would say that really kept us in the loop with everything that happened. And we're actually still kind of upset about, because Marvel, I don't know if you guys know this, but Marvel changed the power level rating system that they used to have on the Marvel Metal cards.
Oh, these, yeah.
Because like, I think Spider-Man's like now the strength of 2 or something like that. We're like, bull, he is the strength of 4.
What is this?
And they brought his intelligence down to like level 5. We're like, his intelligence is 7. He is smarter than Tony Stark, and he's on par with Reed Richards. You're telling me that he's down 2 levels? Screw you, whatever. I was like, I don't. So half the time people are like, because my friends still ask me because they refuse to read comics. They're like, who's stronger than who? And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to go based off of the 1997 Marvel Metal card system because the new system's bogus. Yeah.
Hold on. Are you talking 97 Marvel card power levels, or are you going?
It doesn't even matter anymore. That's what I go by because it makes the most sense. Like now, if you look at it on the Marvel like website, it's so much crap. It doesn't make any sense because you're like, no, you can't be strength of 2 and be able to pick up a tank. Get out of here. So,
please quantify this strength level with a, you know, pounds per square inch pressure, you know, measurement.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Cause, God, that stuff is so funny.
They got really scientific with it, although I never understood the energy blast one.
Well, they had to. Look at their fan base.
Yeah, but like Magneto had energy blast level of 7. And it's like, he's just the master of magnetism. He doesn't actually shoot any blasts. But I guess if you look at the cartoon series, he's shooting out some purple ray or something. But
yeah, that, you know, that's kind of interesting because nowadays some people complain about there being a saturation of superhero media with all the movies coming out. But when I was a kid, like there was just as much stuff. It was just on Saturday morning cartoons with the X-Men cartoon, Batman the Animated Series. All that stuff. And then the movies, I mean, there was Dick Tracy movies, Phantom movies, The Shadow. There were so many superhero movies that came out when I was a kid. It's never really changed. The biggest difference now is they're actually big budget, enjoyable films.
Are you telling me you don't enjoy The Shadow or The Phantom?
It's been a while. I still have fond memories of The Rocketeer. That's one I think might hold
up. The Rocketeer was fantastic. I rewatched The Phantom back in college one summer, and...
Why can't you be cool like your friend Billy
exactly.
Zane?
Exactly. I was like, Billy Zane is way too cool in this movie, but at the same time, I'm like, this movie is terrible. but I love it so much. And Alec Baldwin as the Shadow. Come on. Tim Curry's randomly in that movie too.
It's so weird. It's so bizarre that all those movies got made at the same time. Somebody got a hold of that copyright and was able to make Dick Tracy and those movies all at the same time. And they all tried to look like the Tim Burton Batman movie, if I remember correctly.
Wasn't Madonna like the bad guy in Dick Tracy?
Dick Tracy,
Spoiler alerts for a 30-year-old movie or whatever, 25-year-old movie. But yes, it turns out the bad guy is...
Dick Tracy. My brother still shouts that at me like in the middle of the hallway.
That's so interesting. Yeah, that permeation of the culture has always existed. I mean, so speaking of like what I'm reading nowadays, like I think that obviously DC Comics are still my favorite thing because of that childhood connection, but being a fan of Star Wars as a kid and being a fan of sci-fi as a kid, I'm always kind of attracted to that stuff. I still like that stuff in comics. And yeah, I can't really speak to anything else that's really... I can trace back and point to, this is why I read, you know, Kill or Be Killed, or this is why I read Paper Girls, other than being interested in comic books as an art form as a young kid, as I mentioned with the Calvin Hobbes connection. So as far as other genre stuff, I don't see as close of a connection for me personally, but I mean, what about you, Nick? I feel like maybe you have a closer connection to genre stuff that you like as a kid and now.
Yeah, well, I mean, most of what I was reading as a kid was like a lot of science fiction and fantasy stuff. So I was reading like The Golden Compass and all of those Wizard of Oz books. I mean, for those people who don't know, there were a lot. There's a ton of them. It's unbelievable how many there are. Things like that, things like Harry Potter. For those wondering, yes, I got in on that before it was trendy. My first volume of Harry Potter does not have that little square on the spine with the little number in it. So, you know, don't at me. I'm serious.
And he's been down since day one with Harry Potter.
Yes, since day one. Except when that book got left out in the rain when it got lent to my grandpa. So those of you who are looking to come over here and permanently borrow that book, it's too late. It's gone. that being said... I think what's interesting for me is that for being someone who didn't necessarily have a super sheltered childhood, but kind of grew up as the kid of two elementary school teachers, you know, there was a big push for like obviously reading, just reading, and you know, they weren't like, you need to read Treasure Island and then Lord of the Flies and then we're going to go find whatever the fucking rest of the Criterion collection of books would be. You know, they were just like, he's reading, that's all that matters for the most part. But you know, I certainly wasn't, you know, like I said, I wasn't reading a lot of comics and I wasn't watching a ton of cartoons as a kid. So I think, you know, what's interesting is a lot of the things that interest me now probably can go back to certain things that I really didn't take a look at or didn't take a crack at when I was a kid. So, mm-hmm. you know, I had a terribly, awfully vivid imagination. So anything scary was like, no bueno, like completely. Like I didn't even need to open the cover of the Goosebump books. Like I knew it was Bad News Bears. Like sure. They're like, look, it's a, my God, what are those things called? Like it's a dummy, it's the little dummy in the tuxedo, you know, Night of the Living Dummy or whatever that thing was called. And I was like, who even fucking opens this book? Look at that thing. Why would you do that? And then they did like Choose Your Own Adventure Goosebumps. And I was like, are you fucking insane? Like, why don't you just go into your bathroom and, you know, say Biggie Smalls three times into the mirror and just see what happens, okay? But so a lot of things like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, things like that, a lot of those early franchise properties, you know, I wasn't really interested in them at the time. But now I'm sort of like, well, let's take a look at what I missed out on. And what's interesting is that the fan base and the people, you know, the other respective people that are working on that or are interested in that, you know, they've kind of grown up too. And so it's very weird to sort of have my main exposure to these things be these people that have like sort of grown up and curated their own experience with it. And I'm kind of seeing it through that lens, which is kind of fascinating. So there's a lot of that. But like I said, horror is another really interesting thing that just no bueno as a kid, you know, not going to happen. I still remember like they had those books. It was like scary stories for kids or whatever. And they had that black frame around the front cover.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think R.L. Stine worked on those. And one of them was that story. I'm sure you've all heard it with the girl who's got the ribbon around her neck. And everyone's like, oh, why do you wear the ribbon around your neck or whatever? And then on the last page, like she's old or whatever and takes off the ribbon and her head falls off. And I was like, that's it. Childhood ruined. That's it. That's it. Please just look, I've made the call. You need to take me to therapy this exact moment because this is it. Like we are done. I saw Dr. Phil. This is bad. Okay. So horror is something that I'm like really into now, and things like the Alien movies and, and things like Harrow County and books like that. And it's like I would have never been into that as a kid.
Yeah.
And maybe it's just me trying to engage in like exposure therapy now as an adult. But otherwise, like science fiction books, I'm still really big into science fiction, no different than Star Wars when I was a kid. I still take interest in the Star Wars comics, but I'm not digging them, I think, as much as some people are. But no, it's really interesting to see what books I can sort of directly trace to those literature interests, as well as sort of, you know, what I thought was boring or what I thought was stupid then, and now I'm like, well, let's just take a second glance, because of course the 80s is now anyway. So
yeah, it's coming back. It's kind of interesting though to kind of see things that you maybe you're reading, but you don't have a nostalgia for. You're just kind of enjoying it in the moment. Whereas for me, it's like I don't have a big interest in current Ninja Turtles comics because I did that. No, I went through my Ninja Turtles phase, you know, and I went through my Star Wars phase. I love Star Wars, but in my mind, it's always if it didn't happen on the silver screen, it's not canon. I have that sort of thing.
Right.
Because that's, for me, that's, as a kid, like that's what Star Wars was. It was the movies. And I have very little interest in stuff outside of that. You know, whereas DC superheroes, that's always been that connection to the comics for me.
Right. So it's sort of like your ability to engage with an extended universe really depends upon how you sort of engaged with it at first.
Yeah, your first exposure to it. Yeah.
Right. I think that's definitely true.
I think I'm very lucky because I don't actually have a problem with extended universes or anything like that. It literally becomes this point because there was such this long time where it was just grab whatever comics type thing that you can that's around. Because I had that for so long, by the time that I actually had money, like when I was in middle school, I would scrape up like a dollar or two from like change around the house or like walking my aunt's dog or something like that. There was this comic store that was open for like maybe a year or two down the road from my house, and I would just go in and grab whatever looked interesting, and if it was interesting, I would try to find the next issue and never find it. But I would just read that, like Paul was saying, I would just read that one issue over and over and over again. But I think that helped because by the time I was in high school and got back into comics, and I had all this money to spend, it was like, you know what? I'm just going to peruse until I find a cover or a story that really sucks me in. And I'm going to go with that. And when I got back into comics, I did stick with all the superheroes that I knew. Like, I didn't go into Transformers and G.I. Joes, even though that was happening. I went for Spider-Man because Spider-Man was my favorite superhero. And also because of the Spider-Man TV show. And then I also went for Green Lantern because Kyle Rayner was the coolest person ever back in, like, 1998. So I picked up Green Lantern because of that, and then I also picked up Superman because I love Superman because of Christopher Reeves and all that. So I stayed in superhero comics for the longest time, and it wasn't until like halfway through my college experience that I actually started getting into independent comics, and that was just because everyone was telling me, these are really good stories, and I was like, I'm always down for a good story. I think I'm very fortunate that way because I'll still pick up random books, and this is also where it comes in to the manga thing, because I'll read any manga, I'll give it any sort of chance, as long as that basic plot summary sounds at least somewhat interesting. But that's also a double-edged sword, because then I have to read like a million different series.
Yeah,
400 volumes. Yeah,
it's ridiculous.
That's, That's interesting to see how that sort of functions as how one gets their sort of anchor back into, you know, coming back into comics in modern day. You know, like Paul said, you know, he had already started, and so he just naturally, at the very least, when you got back in, like your anchor point was just DC again, right, Paul?
Yeah.
That was just sort of your, like, this is where I'm going to start because I know this.
Yeah, it's so weird because I remember being a kid and really like liking comics and reading all the DC stuff. And then there was a certain point because I had a subscription to Wizard Magazine too. So I was reading all that Wizard stuff and I would buy the random issues of X-Men because they were supposed to be cool and never really getting it. But it actually at a pretty young age, as like a, you know, early teenager, I kind of got tapped out on all the big event stuff going on in superhero comics and started reading weirder stuff like Bone or Madman. And reading some Dark Horse stuff as kind of a teenager, which is, I kind of faded out of the superhero stuff. So when I came back into reading comics in graduate school, which I think it was like 2007, 2008, Final Crisis was going on. So I'm like, all right, here's a big DC event. I know Grant Morrison's a good writer because I remember reading his JLA run when it was happening. So that was my entry point back in. And that was kind of a perfect thing because it was that same experience of my childhood of saying, okay, I don't know exactly what's going on, but I want to find out who all these characters are, how they're connected, how it ties into the bigger DC multiverse. So it was a very sort of nostalgic experience to dive back in with Final Crisis and relive that same excitement I had as a kid of just rereading issues over and over again and figuring out who these people were.
And that's so interesting because that's so different from a lot of modern people that are getting into comics now, where especially if your entry point is someone who's been reading comics for a while, your entry point might be, I don't know, Saga or Walking Dead or something like that. And so you just kind of skip the whole big two thing altogether.
Yeah.
And I would love to know how many of those people have actually genuinely never, ever delved into the whole big two experience with all of the benefits and all of the negatives that come with that.
Yeah.
So that's interesting to me.
I mean, I got to say, being someone who remembers when Image Comics started, it's fascinating to me when I came back into comics and seeing what Image was in the mid 2000s. And
it's no longer the darkness in Spawn.
Yeah, I just remember
because when
Spawn.
I was a kid, that's how I Spawn,
or as I call it, the good days. No, I'm just kidding.
The good days. Yeah, I mean, in my mind, I always had that thing where it's like, oh yeah, Image, that's where Rob Liefeld is doing his weird X-Men ripoffs, like Youngblood.
That's where people are edgy as fuck, because they're renegades and rebels, and everyone just wishes they could be Image Comics sitting over in the corner smoking a cigarette and wearing the leather jacket.
Yeah, I think I remember reading a lot of Gen 13, and no one really remembers that
book. Oh,
God. The early Image books, I had a ton of issues, and I've just recently found old back issues of that and started reading them again, and it hasn't aged well, but there's something about, I remember being like a 13-year-old boy and reading those comics and having a connection to them for certain reasons, and it's just weird to go back as a 35-year-old and say, boy, that's really weird that I was into this stuff, so...
Oh, man. Yeah. No, I remember I used to go into a comic book shop that was a hobby store, which is where I got my Star Wars cards as a kid. And I would always just browse the comics when I was bored and waiting for my dad to finish up his guitar lesson down the street. And I still remember, like, this was when all of, like, the darkness and all of the Witchblade stuff was coming out.
Yeah.
And it was that moment when you're, like a 10-year-old kid and you're just staring at this stuff and you're like, something is weird and wrong about all of this, but I really can't explain it. I'll just leave this for 20 years from now when I have to explain it to a, you know, professional adult. So,
yeah.
So, yeah, that's I guess that's the comics are weird and we're old and nostalgia is a very, very dangerous double-edged sword that you should engage with carefully and cautiously, because
it's interesting to see how influential those early influences are, those early moments. I mean, I can definitely trace my social and political viewpoints to reading Mad Magazine when I was way too young to be reading Mad Magazine. So,
oh, that's interesting. Yeah,
that's a whole other topic. But yeah, I think it's interesting. I feel like all of us on the show right now kind of have at least some childhood connection to comic books. I'd be curious to hear anybody that's listened to the show and wants to share it with us their experience of being someone at college age. A new fan or someone that discovered comics through not the big two. That's so fascinating to me to that other aspect of it, that other approach.
Yeah, definitely. So if you're listening to the show, you know, send us an email, hit us up on Twitter, you know, let us know what you were you reading as a kid? Were you reading comics? Were you not reading comics at all? Are you someone who's gotten back into comics now, or is this something you've just been doing your whole life? Because you can't get enough Aquaman forever and forever. And there's nothing wrong with that. Just don't forget, at one point, he had a hook.
And a sword. He had a sword at one point.
A sword.
He had a sword because Superboy Prime...
What was it made of?
Superboy Prime had a huge problem with the sword in during, like, I think it was Infinite Crisis or Sinestro Corps War.
Yeah.
Because he beats the living crap out of Aquaman, and his only like response, he goes, "Aquaman's not supposed to have a sword."
Wow.
And it's fantastic because he's great. Like literally beating people to death, and he's like, that's the thing he's focused on. You're a psycho.
I feel like for a while, the Aquaman philosophy was why not? Just why not?
It's thrown.
We can't get things any worse than they are.
Just
so
throw
just
it at the
not?
Wall and see what sticks.
I still love In Brightest Day when Black Manta cuts his hand off again after he's just gotten it back, and he goes, "You should be used to that." And I was like, "That is savage! Oh my god!"
That's a deep cut. Get it?
Oh,
okay. Well,
on that note, I will leave our listeners with a mission. If you really want to know how bad Aquaman got, just go ahead, hop on the Googles, and look up Aquaman's blue suit. Okay, I think it's what he had in the 80s. If you really want to see the depths of depravity, go look up his blue suit. It will change your life forever.
If you want to go deep sea diving for Aquaman.
Yeah.
All right. Nice one. All right. We got to cut this out. Okay.
Yeah.
Enough with the puns. So... Nick, you mentioned Twitter, and again, readers or listeners, both probably, if you want to hit us up on Twitter, you can find us at IRCB Podcast. We're on there posting and sharing. There's usually a poll every week that Mike writes, and it's usually X-Men related, so if that's your jam, you could check that out. You can follow me on Twitter at OhHiPaulie, that's OhHiPaulie. Nick, I can never remember your Twitter handle, so you have to tell the listeners.
Yeah, it's Death Star Plans, DETH, star is fully spelled out, and then PLNZ. I'm pretty certain, even I might have gotten it wrong. There's a real easy solution to this, guys. Just go to the IRCB Twitter page. We're all on there all the time, and just go ahead and connect with us that way, I suppose.
What about you, Renee? What's your handle there on Twitter?
My handle is actually very simple. It's Rodriguer29. It's my last name.
Perfect. Well, God bless you for making this.
Well, it was the password from like my middle or no, it was my username from computer class in middle school.
Careful, Renee. Like,
wasn't the password?
Well, it was my current password for my.
No, it's not. Shit. I said it wrong. It's the username because it's your last name with your first initial, but my last name is Rodriguez. It's too long, so they chopped off the EZ, so it's Rodriguez. And then it was our first initial, and then 29 was my soccer number. But it's funny because all my brothers are like Rodrigua, Rodrigug, Rodrigud, and it was just really funny. So we'd call each other that like in the house. It was a good time. But yeah, Rodriguer29, that's me on Twitter.
You can also check out our website, ircbpodcast.com. We'll be posting new episodes there, obviously, as well as the show notes. So if there's a book we mentioned in passing, you want to remember what it was, find it on there. We also have our weekly pull lists on there that we share every Tuesday. There's also a Goodreads group. We talk about this once a month. We have an episode dedicated to it, but it's always ongoing. There's a bunch of weekly conversations and discussions about what people are reading. It's a lot of fun, and shout out to Kate Scotchwiss for making that a great place to hang out and discuss comics.
Please rate, subscribe, and tell your friends all about the show. And you can also, like Nick said earlier, you can email us at ircb@destroythesaib.org. So please reach out. We love talking to you.
Otherwise, we also want to give a big thanks to Infinity Shred. They're the ones that provide all of our music, and if you've been digging all of that awesome synth electronic score and you've been wondering where it comes from, it's Infinity Shred. They're great. Beyond that, I just want to point out, you know what, every week Mike says something about Xander. Xander's a magical wizard. Xander's a fantastic unicorn from the ethers of Nevermore. Things like this. You know what? I'm just going to set the record straight. Xander is a real human being and a real hero. To quote the late, great Ryan Gosling from Drive. And the fact that he is a mortal, fallible human being just like the rest of us, who makes all of this magic come true every week, makes it that much more special. There you go. Otherwise, thank you for listening. Tell your friends, tell the people that aren't your friends, tell the people you don't even know, because they might even already know about it. And look at that, now you have a new friend with a shared interest. You're welcome.
That's what we do here. We bring people together.
Exactly.
Perfect.
That was good.
What?
That was good.
Yep.
Xander's gonna kill me.
Yeah.
That was the biggest tangent ever. Oh my gosh. Just for the ending. That was beautiful.
I'd love to say that it's just off the top of my head, but I've been thinking about that for a week. I was like, you know what? I think we're going to riff on the credits, just because there's nothing that would probably really set Xander off quite like that.
Oh my gosh.
Great.
Deep cuts, everyone.